This is Alan Tritton, recorded at Peterhouse College, Cambridge, on the 15th of September 2007 by Chris Eldon Lee. Alan Tritton.
Well, my name is Alan, A-L-A-N, George Tritton, and I was born in 1931 in Knutsford, actually.
In Cheshire.
In Cheshire. As my father was working in Manchester at that particular time.
What were you doing before FIDS?
I was a lieutenant in the army fighting against the Chinese communists in the jungle in Malaya. But if you really want to know, I was rather badly wounded and I was repatriated.
I was going to say there's quite a big leap from there to the Antarctic. How did that leap take place?
Well, anything was more desirable compared with the jungle, where you had very high temperatures and very high humidity, and you were fighting, and you were... And anyway, in fact, I always wanted to go to the polar regions, ever since I was at school, and even before, even at my private school, preparatory school. In fact, actually, when you left... I call them preparatory school, actually, private school. I lectured on the 1924 Mount Everest expedition because I was very interested in geological and glaciological aspects. And, in fact, I had a very good geography master there. And little did I know, actually, in 1943-44, when I gave my leaving lecture on the Everest expedition, that I would be with Chris Bonington on the 1975 Everest Southwest Face Expedition. So it was something.
A moment of fate.
Yes, yes.
Do you know why you'd always wanted to go to the Antarctic? What was the attraction?
Well, I love the hills and the mountains. I love the snow and the ice. My family, on one side of my family, were... travel very extensively. And I think really the motivator came from this extraordinary man I had as a geography master at my preparatory school, which had evacuated up to Yorkshire because the school was being bombed and shelled in 1940.
Where was the school?
Broadstairs in Kent. The school evacuated up there. The actual geography master was called Commander Holmes, and in the First World War he had been a submarine commander in the Royal Navy. But he was a passionate geographer and glaciologist, and the limestone area around where we had evacuated to, which was effectively one side, Penigent and Ingleborough, was of absorbing interest, and he rather took me under his wing and opened the whole geomorphology and geography and glaciology to me, which I never actually forgot. And in my book, which is being published next spring, I think, it will show the profound influence that Commander Holmes of the Royal Navy had on me.
What will the book be called, sir?
It's going to be called The Half-Closed Door. And the reason for that is that Jan Morris, I don't know if you know Jan Morris, I knew her, I've known her both as a man and as a woman. And she was on the 1953, the first Everest expedition under my old friend John Hunt. And she wrote a book, many books actually, but one of their books was a sort of imperial trilogy. And the last one of that ilk, so to speak, was called Farewell the Trumpets. And the preface to the book was, say farewell to the trumpets, you will hear them no more, but their sweet, sad, silvery echo will call to you still through the half-closed door. And the reason for my calling is that on my mother's side were all soldiers. My mother's family was an impoverished Highland aristocratic military family. In other words, they have to live on their pay. And so they served the empire all over the world. And they never had any money. And And they died in Mesopotamia, India, Egypt, the Sudan, France, and but they were professional imperial soldiers, actually. And so, and I was a soldier as well. And so I thought the half-closed door sort of sounded a bit right.
All right. So we've established the passion to go to the Antarctic.
Yes.
How did it actually happen? How did you actually materialise that passion?
Well, I will tell you exactly what happened. When I eventually came out of the army, and having been 6 months in hospital, I was discharged, and I tried to go on Commander Simpson's British North Greenland expedition in 1954-5. But by the time I came out of the army, and he wrote a very nice letter to me, but he said he was full up, and of course whether he would have accepted me or not, I don't know. But he was full up, so I was rather dispirited about that, but not entirely dispirited, because I actually did want to go to the Antarctic rather than the Arctic. It was more of an adventure. And so, out of the blue, I wrote to a friend of mine, Vic Russell. Who,
I know his daughter.
I know his daughter, who actually, Kirith Love is a relation of mine. He died. He's dead.
He died a couple of years ago.
Yes, that's right. Yes. And I knew him. I didn't know him terribly well, but I wrote to him. And I also wrote to Lancelot Fleming, who I knew, and said that I very much wanted to go down to the Antarctic. I wasn't terribly well qualified, as I hadn't been to university. And so, you know, armed with the letters, you know, from Vic Russell and Lance Fleming. Lance Fleming was Bishop of Portsmouth at that particular time. And I went to see them, and I said, I very much want to go south. And they were all very sort of positive about it. So I was emboldened to write to the Crown agents, who were the people in those days in, you know, acting for the Falkland Island Independences. And I went there for an interview, and then I was accepted.
Do you remember the interview? Was it a stiff one, or...?
Actually, as it was 55 years ago, I don't. I think that they were actually interested because I'd first of all been on a mountaineering expedition in the Arctic Norway when I was 17. I went up to the Sulitjelma range, which straddles Norway and Sweden at the top there, and went sort of mountaineering. And I think they were also impressed, so there was a thing there. And I think they were also impressed because, you know, I'd been commissioned and had actually fought in command of 20-25 men in the jungle on my own for long periods of time, being supplied by air. And I think that I made possibly a good impression.
Do you remember who was on the other side of the table? Was Fuchs there? You don't know.
No, it wasn't Fuchs, certainly not. No. No, I mean, I have no idea, actually, to this day. I mean, they didn't make any impression on me.
What do you recall of that period then, having been given the job? I mean, were you given a job, or were you just sent south?
No. I was accepted into the service of the Falkland Island Dependency Survey, and I said, I'm not really very qualified. I will wait for time.
Yeah.
And they said, well, I think you ought to be trained as a meteorologist. Everybody got it. And so I went for 3 months off to Stanmore, which was the Met Office, which was then controlled by the Air Ministry. And I have to say, I commuted up to Stanmore, and I have to say, I find it absolutely fascinating. And I thoroughly enjoyed that. And then I was given my, so to speak, my embarkation orders. Second time I'd been given embarkation orders, once to the Far East and once to the South. And joined the Biscoe in October 1952. at Southampton.
Did you have to? Were there special preparations, equipment you had to gather together, or did you travel very light?
Gosh. No, I think I travelled very, very light, and I think, thinking about it now, you asking me with that particular question, I think pretty well all the equipment was picked up in Stanley. I cannot remember that I took, or perhaps I did, but I can't remember taking a whole lot of mucklucks and, you know, that sort of thing. I think I picked them up in Stanley. And the voyage south, I was, in fact, very surprised, because I was then actually only 21, just 21 at the time, and I'd already been in the army for 2.5 years. I was very surprised when I arrived at Portsmouth, or Southampton, or wherever it was, because I was told where the ship was berthed, and I went there, and I couldn't see anything. I said, there isn't a ship. And somebody said, there is, but you can't see it. It's below the dock. And the only thing that, in fact, was sticking up above the dock level was the crow's nest. But there were a lot of television people there and film crew actually filming our departure. And it was not dissimilar to a troop ship leaving for the Far East, actually. And I also remember particularly that the ship was grossly overloaded. And quite a lot of the deck cargo came adrift in a huge gale we had in the Biscay. I mean, it was an absolute dreadful storm.
Touch and go?
It was touch and go. And the wardroom got flooded. Where we were, all our bunk, where we were, which is down the companionway, as they called it, was completely flooded with water, about 3 foot deep, before they could actually... it was a very severe gale. The engine stopped, we were hove to for a very long time, and the deck cargo, most of it, all the hydrogen cylinders broke away and damaged the scow and everything like that. It was a... what we in the Fids used to call a fornicator.
Yes, I've heard that phrase from Kevin Walton before. Yeah.
Anyway, after that, we had a very good trip down to Montevideo and Stanley, and it was a good trip.
I presume that Cygnia was pretty basic.
Yes, we left Stanley, and we relieved Deception, which is a horrible place. Hope Bay, Port La Croix, I think. I've written all this in my book. And, yes, we arrived at Cygnia. And I've described it at length in my book, actually.
In a nutshell.
It wasn't anything I wasn't expecting, actually. I did expect something like that. But, I mean, compared to what... now, I mean, yes, it was extremely basic. We all lived, slept, and ate in the same room and had one coke fire, or anthracite, I suppose. And you were not allowed to let it go out on pain of death. We all took turns in cooking. Yes, it was very basic, but it was... It didn't worry me at all. I was the leader, of course, I was chosen as the leader... in Stanley.
Oh, I see. You didn't know you were going to be the leader until you got to Stanley.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so I was interviewed by the autocrat, Sir Miles Clifford, who had a sort of, what do they call him in his eye?
Monocle.
Very, very imperial, autocratic, and his wife was drinking gin rather heavily. And... he said, my boy, I think you ought to be the leader of Cygnia. I said to him, I don't want to go to Cygnia. And the reason why I don't want to Cygnia, I want to go to Hope Bay to do the sledging survey journeys. No, he said, you'll have to go to Cygnia. So I said, orders is orders, so to speak. And so I went to Cygnia and took over from a very capable, competent, efficient man called Arthur Mansfield. And there were five of us there. We were all together there for 15 months, all living together. there was no incompatibility. We all came from very different backgrounds, totally different backgrounds, actually. We all lived and slept and ate in the same room. There was no incompatibility at all.
Did that surprise you?
Well, it did surprise me, but it didn't surprise me all that much, because when you're fighting in the jungle...
Same rules apply.
Same rule. They rely on you, you rely on them. They fight with you, you fight with them. You have their food, I have their food, we're all together. We were totally interdependent, so it wasn't anything different. And I didn't find, because I'm, you know, was at a public school and all that sort of thing, I don't know what they thought of me, but there wasn't any tension, put it that way, even in the winter. So I was very fortunate, and we shared everything, actually. We shared the cooking, feeding the dogs, everything. And as I say, I was rather proud of the fact that there was no tension, actually. There could easily have been tension. As I say, we came from very different backgrounds. So I actually, thoroughly, even in, you know, the benefit of hindsight and, you know, the golden glow, you know, and all the rest of it passed, it was a very happy time for me.
After Malaysia, how do you handle the cold?
Well, put it the other way around, I much prefer the cold to the heat, particularly humid heat. The jungle, you don't get used to the jungle. You always feel ill in the jungle. You're always wet. You're always sweating. You're soaked. You've got jungle sores. You have leeches. You have fear. Everything is. You always came out of the jungle feeling ill, looking dreadful and green and awful and sores and fevers and things like that. But of course, I'd have had a moment's illness in the Antarctic at all.
Well, the Antarctic is a pristine.
Yes. There was one thing I do remember before going down to it. My father, who I never knew, died when I was 2 years old as a result of a gangrenous appendicitis which burst. And of course, one forgets that in 1933-34 there was no antibiotics. So he died in great agony. I never knew of it. And I remember thinking about it for a long time as to whether, in fact, I should have had my appendix out because of this history before I went south. In the end, I decided not to, and it was, benefit of hindsight, it was the right decision.
What was the... Was the tasks that you had to perform sophisticated or very rudimentary?
Fairly rudimentary. It was the days and nights were fully taken up. In fact, I can almost honestly say I hardly had time to read a book. If you were a Met man, there were three Met people, and we did, you know, all the Met work and so on and so forth, another glacier, and I also did a fair amount of glaciological and geological work, as well as all the seal counting, penguin counting, and all that sort of type of thing. Sorry, I forgot what you said now.
Well, I was asking you about the nature.
Yes. Well, there was a routine. Every 5 weeks, you were cooked for the 5 days of the week, and you had to cook all the meals, and there were three meals a day.
Decent food?
Yes, there was no worry about the food at all. We ate quite a lot of seal meat and penguin meat. And in fact, actually, I'll have to tell you a little story at this point, and that is that I learned all my cooking from a book called The Penguin Cookery Book. Now, this Penguin Cookery Book was written by somebody called B. Nilsson, who you may know or may not know, probably not know. Anyway, rather facetiously, I wrote to B. Nilsson, and I said, I was pretty young and stupid in those days, I have learned all my cooking out of your Penguin Cookery Book. I greatly admire and respect it. But, of course, there are no recipes for cooking penguins in your Penguin Cookery Book. Oh, she said, how very interesting. And she said, do send me all your recipes, which I did, actually. And I had a very nice letter back from her. The other thing, in fact, which was fairly rudimentary, is of course there were no bathing facilities. And I had a bath in a whale oil barrel once a month, I think, which I thought was quite excessive. And the reason why we didn't have bars is simply because you had to chop up so many snow blocks and shove them in the bloody, whatever, boiler thing or whatever it was. And it was a work of Sisyphus, really, pushing these bloody snow blocks in order to eventually acquire enough water to have a bath. But yes, it was a pretty unsophisticated life. It wasn't technical. The dogs, nothing was really sort of... The routine for the Met assistants, meteorologists, and two were qualified, I was the unqualified one, was that you got up at 6 o'clock in the morning and you went all the way through to 3 o'clock the next morning. In other words, it was a 21-hour day. And then you were allowed to sleep in till midday. And then you had the next day off. And then you started again. But in between time, we did quite a number of sledging journeys over to Coronation, although it wasn't a very good ice year. I think the ice came in April or May, and unfortunately went out in August. So some of our journeys to Coronation, although we did quite a lot of climbing on Coronation, it would have been nice if the sea ice had stayed in longer.
Were those trips a recreation rather than...
No, they weren't. No, they. I was asked to do them for geological reasons, and not for anything else. And as I went along, the south coast of Coronation Island, as well as, of course, Cygnia as well, I picked up a lot of geological specimens. And then it was from that and other reports that... It was Derek Bailing and somebody else wrote the geological report on what they had discovered, and also what I had discovered. And they were very kind to me because I'm amateurish. They gave me a very nice thank you for all the work I did.
Was the work you were doing scientifically sound, or was it a bit...
I don't think in my case anything I did was scientifically sound in the way you're asking it. But I collected a lot of information of various things which enabled others to write the various scientific reports.
You were the gatherer-hunter.
I was the gatherer-hunter. I mean, I did write, for instance, the geological and glaciological report on my little mountaineering expedition in the Arctic. But no, I'm not qualified as a scientist. But I'm interested.
Back to the conditions on the base. The topic which everybody seems to bring up is the toilet facilities.
Oh, well, yes. Well, in my day, it was a thing called the Bingham Bog. And the thing about this, again, is in my book. The reason for the Bingham Bog was it was designed by Surgeon Commander Bingham. It was outside. And unfortunately, it was situated the wrong side of the hut. For a pee, if I can call it that, you went to the front door, or front, whatever it was, and there was a pee glacier there, which melted in the summer. So you didn't, if you just wanted to pee, that was all right. If you wanted to do anything else, you had, and hopefully not in the middle of the night, or winter or anything like that, you had to go round the hut in a blizzard, and you sat on this seat with the great admonition in front of you in writing, saying, no micturation before defecation. And the reason for that is that if you actually peed in the biscuit tin before you, defecated, it made it impossibly heavy to get the biscuit tin down to the tide crack. Which was between the land ice and the sea ice. It was impossibly heavy. So, as I say, there was this great admonition, no micturation before defecation, and, of course, you didn't.
So, just to clarify that point, you peed elsewhere.
Oh, yeah.
And you defecated it in the toilet.
In the bog. We all called it a bog. It wasn't a toilet in any accepted sense of the word.
And that was outside around the back of the hut.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll show it to you. And then the generator shed, because we started up the generator in the morning. We had no light at night. He said, "Oh, no, we didn't, because we didn't have the generator." And somebody, we took it in turns to go out in the morning to start the generator up, because we're utterly dependent on the generator, particularly not only for light, but of course also for wireless transmissions, which we conducted all the time. But that, and sometimes I call the generator the crouching beast, because sometimes it was extremely reluctant to start because it was so cold. Yeah. In fact, I think we used to put some ether or something in there to really go give it a kick.
So there'd be no oil lamps or candles in the hatch. You went to bed at...
No, we did have oil lamps and candles. But the generator was turned off, as far as I recollect, and I'm not absolutely certain, but when we went to bed. Mm-hmm. And then we were in, I say, we all lived and slept in the slave room. And I had a bunk. I was there for nearly 15 months, something like that. I never changed my sleeping bag, or it must have been terribly smelly, actually. I was quite happy in it. I had a lovely view.
So did the Antarctic live up to expectations?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yes. And I was very fortunate, because when I left Cygne in 1954, I went on the Antarctic relief voyage, and which was fairly normal, except that, in fact, actually, two things happened. First of all, we built the International Geophysical Year Station at Argentine Islands on Galindas Island. So we were there nearly 2 months building, and we had most incredible weather, wonderful weather, and we built this new IGY station there. So that was lovely. And it's down the west coast of the peninsula, Graham Land. And the other thing, apart from we went several times to South Georgia, and then the other great bonus, although in one sense you could say it wasn't a bonus, we went down all the way down in winter to inspect, actually that's not quite the right word, every island in the South Sandwich Islands. You know where those are. For any signs of Argentinian presence. Well, there wasn't.
And that was in which year?
That was in early 54. And we went down from South Georgia and didn't discover anything. But, of course, it was in May. So, I mean, the actual voyage itself was absolute hell. Mm. So, but we were lucky to see them, because they hadn't been really surveyed at all. They weren't surveyed properly until 1963-64, I think, the South Sandwich Islands.
Did you then do some basic survey work on Cygne whilst you were there? Was it purely all meteorological stuff?
We didn't do any geographical survey work, no. I did geological and glaciological, which I've touched on, which was my contribution to Derek Malin's... remember who the other person was. I'd been Gordon Robin. But I did all the seal counts, all the bird counts, you know, all that sort of type of thing. I kept very regular records for all that. And they all ended up in Stanley, or I suppose in London.
Did you sense at the time that this was really important pioneering stuff you were doing?
Oh, not pioneering, no. No, because in fact, it wasn't, you know, a primary survey like Hope Bay was doing down the east coast of the peninsula, which is actually what I would have liked to have done. But on the other hand, it was intensely interesting. And Coronation Island, which we spent quite a lot of time on, hadn't been surveyed in those days. Not properly surveyed, anyway. We didn't survey it, but we spent quite a lot of time there.
You were there for the coronation?
Yes, and you know the story.
Well, no, please tell me.
Ah, yes. Well, I'll tell you the story, which I was very angry about at the time, because we were actually on coronation at the time of the coronation. And I sent a wireless message to the Majesty Queen, say, we, Falkland Island Dependency Surveyors on Coronation Island, send our felicitations to you on your coronation. So that got through all right. And by the relief boat, we had a photograph signed by Her Majesty the Queen saying, thank you very much indeed for this. But I was bawled out by the governor, Sir Miles Clifford, and I had a message from him, although afterwards we became good friends, saying I'd usurped his authority by sending a message to Her Majesty the Queen without his authority. I thought, well... That was quite funny.
And what was this this protest note business for the RGs?
Well, that was very, very, very peculiar, actually. But it all, I think I've written about it, it's slightly embellished. But the thing is that when the Argentinians put a base on Deception Island, and this was in 1953, Churchill sent, a cruiser, to destroy it, and the Royal Marines went ashore and destroyed it. And then suddenly I had this message saying, expect reprisals as a result of the action on Deception Island, and it was, all in this four-figure naval code, which I found extremely difficult to decipher, actually. Anyway, I did. So I sent a cipher back direct to the Admiralty and said, well, what do you expect me to do? Which is in my book, actually. And they said, well, you've got to make a formal protest in the name of Her Majesty the Queen that, the Argentinians are infringing Her Majesty's territorial, sovereignty or something, crap like that. Sorry, excuse my language. But I said, well, what do I do? I've only got a very leaky pram, which did leak, actually. And I've only got a shotgun, which happens to belong to me, and with a few guns. Well, they sort of, as far as I recall, said, well, do your best. Well, anyway, it wasn't very satisfactory. But I can't remember whether I ever actually told them, but I don't think I did. I didn't want to tell anybody very much about it, so I kept it quiet.
But you went and made the protest?
Yeah, I did, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And how was it received?
I said, you're infringing the president's sovereign waters. So I said, well, stuff you. Anyway, we had a glass of whiskey and that was the end of that.
Oh, just a glass of whiskey. There was no prolonged celebration.
No. I was a bit embarrassed about the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that communications were a bit patchy. So, in your 15 months there, were you able to speak at all to England or to?
No, never.
Your mother or? Never.
No, I think I. No. We couldn't do that. All I think is I used to send occasionally the odd wireless message home. But I'm not absolutely certain I even did that, actually. I think that FIDS in London did actually send my mother occasional reports as to what was going on or not going on, as the case may be.
Not composed by you?
No. I don't think, in fact, I did it once. It's rather like I was in Malaya. I never actually spoke to my mother at all, because actually you couldn't do it. No, I think there was no communication per se between my mother and myself when I was down south, at all.
When the time came to go back to civilization, for want of a better
word. Yes.
How did you feel about that?
Well, the thing is that, again, it's in my book. When I left Sydney, it was a filthy day, and I asked myself the question when I left Sydney, whether, in fact, I was sorry to leave. And the answer was, I wasn't sorry to leave. And the reason why I wasn't sorry to leave, because I was going on for about 6 months on the Biscay doing these very extensive sea journeys, and particularly, as I say, 2 months building the IGY scientific station at Galindas in the Argentine Islands. But when that was all over, and going out on the so-called expedition is always very exciting, going back is depressing in the extreme. And Montevideo was great fun because, you know, it was on nightclubs and bars and that sort of type of thing. And the ship had been slightly damaged in pack ice, so we were there a bit longer. So I in fact, and again, I put this in my book, I spent all my available cash in a bar in Montevideo on the first night. So I went to the captain, who I think had been put into jail for being drunk, Bill Johnson, who was a great character, and said, can you lend me some money or give me advance on my pay? And he said, no. So I was actually there in Montevideo without any visible cash or anything like that. So I went back to the nightclub. Is this what you want to talk about? Mm-hmm. And I went to the proprietor, and there was a very nice girl there, and said, look, I'm a pianist. I play jazz and classical. But when your band's not here, I can, you know, fill in, so to speak. And I said, I haven't got any money, but what I'd like is free drinks and to be able to sit at the bar and chat to the girls and all the rest of it. So he said, yes. So I survived in Montevideo without any money. I think it was in about a week, I think. Anyway, it was. But anyway, after that, it was depressing in the extreme. And arriving back at Portsmouth or Southampton with all them, you have to remember, in 1950, those years, England was the most depressing place. It was grey and bomb, nobody had money, it was rationing. You just wanted to get out of it, actually, England.
Did you?
No, I didn't. What happened, actually, that I had no really idea what to do. So I went into a bank, which wasn't quite my sort of thing, but I happened to stayed in the bank, and I became a group executive director of Barclays. So it sort of worked out all right. But I continued expeditioning, and I was on help with the British Transarctic Expedition, the Transglobe Expedition, Chris Bonington's expedition to Everest, and, you know, I've sort of participated in them all. So I've kept that all alive, and then I spent a great deal of time in India. And again, if you pick up my book, you'll see what I achieved in India. And then I was given the CBE for what I achieved in India, which was basically restoration and conservation, and of working, in a sense, indirectly for the Indian Museum Service. And the British government gave me a CBE for all that, and then other things happened.
In a long and colourful life, how does the Antarctic rate?
Top.
Really?
No, absolutely top.
Because
of the beauty and the spiritual beauty of it. I was never happier, to some extent, when I was, it's again in my book, we were climbing on the Kulins and elsewhere on Coronation Island in the winter. And it was so, there was actually no wind, it was a beautiful day, it was pack ice everywhere. And it was so beautiful and serene. I'm rather religious. It was quite spiritual. And I've never seen anything quite so beautiful as the Antarctic in my life. And I mean that, actually. I was sort of, I loved it. Absolutely loved it. And it was one of the happiest periods in my life. There you are.
Have you been back?
Yes, I went once back to South Georgia as a lecturer. And, I knew South... I'd been to South Georgia several times. Well, I wasn't really a lecturer. Bob Burton was doing the lecturing. And, of course, you know, it's very different being on a tourist ship. It's all very different. Bob Headland would tell you that, actually. You know Bob Headland? Yeah. It was very different. It was, you know, having your sort of claret in the evening. I mean, but curiously, one of the things which a lot of people have asked me, and we must go, is that did you drink? And the answer was we didn't drink. None of us actually wanted to drink. What we did do was smoke. But then I smoked in the Malaya, and I still smoke a bit. And the reason why one smoked in Malaya is to get all these bloody leeches off one's body. And we did it every hour. But we didn't. There was no desire to drink, actually. Which is interesting. Mm-hmm. To me, anyway. Anyway, is that all? You want to ask me another question?
Thank you. Thank you very much.